All righty, we are underway with session 21, page 156 in your outline. So let's do a quick review of where we were last week. We're entering the final section of your notebook, the fourth section, which I call Israel Present, Modern Israel. Last week, we looked at the Declaration of the State of Israel, as Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence in the Tel Aviv Museum. And here's the headlines in the Palestine Post, soon to become the Jerusalem Post: "The State of Israel is born." Immediately, six Arab countries attacked. Egypt, starting from the south to the north, Egypt in the south, then moving northward, the Jordanians, then the Iraqis, the Syrians, the Arab Liberation Army to the far north, and also the Lebanese army as well. So the nation which could not be squeezed out of existence politically, the attempt is now to squeeze it out of existence militarily. One of the more famous battles is the battle at Degania, where the Syrian troops came down from the Golan Heights. 45 tanks came down the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, overrunning a number of the kibbutzim. And then they ran smack dab into Degania, little kibbutz Degania, the first kibbutz to be made in the Holy Land in Israel. There's kibbutz Degania today. And the commander of kibbutz Degania was Moshe Dayan. And 80-year-old howitzers were called up from the coast, disassembled, rushed to Degania. The first one thrown together and fired as the first Syrian tank clattered through the boundaries of Degania. The howitzer made a direct hit on this tank. The other 44 turned tail and hightailed it back up the hill, back up the Golan Heights. This was the only one who did not retreat, and he is on display in kibbutz Degania. So Degania survived. On the southern front, southwestern front, Brigadier General Mohammed Naguib of the Egyptian forces was making his way up out of Egypt, up the Gaza Strip. As he came up the Gaza Strip, he ran smack dab into kibbutz Yad Mordechai. And Yad Mordechai held off this Egyptian battalion for 6 days, 5 or 6 days of intense shelling and bombardment before they abandoned the kibbutz. But Yad Mordechai's stand slowed down the Egyptian army and caused them to move very carefully and slowly, and eventually saved Tel Aviv from being overrun. So this is another key battle in the southern front. Then we turned our attention to the battle for Jerusalem. Again, I recommend this book, O Jerusalem, to you for that battle. The Jordanian legion began by attacking the northern boundaries of the city. They were driven back. They then attempted to attack the southern boundaries of the city, Ramat Rachel. And again, after very fierce fighting, probably the fiercest fighting of the war, Ramat Rachel held out. And so now the modern city of Jerusalem was safe from being overrun. But the old city did not hold out. And this is a picture of the Jewish refugees fleeing the Jewish quarter of the old city through the Zion Gate. So now Jerusalem is under siege by the Arab forces. And the only way to break that siege is the main road, but it's blocked by the fortress at Latrun. The Arabs, of course, the Arab Legion controlled the fortress of Latrun, the French police station there. And their gunners high above the fields of Latrun were able to just rake the Israeli, the IDF, as they tried to attack. And the soldiers that were trying to attack Latrun, most of them were Holocaust survivors that had never carried a gun before. So it was a bloodbath. Wow. So it looked like Jerusalem would not break the siege, but Colonel Mickey Marcus, an American volunteer, theorized that a footpath to the south of Latrun could be widened into a road, and trucks could pass on that road. And his story is found in the book Cast the Giant's Shadow, available on Amazon.com if you'd like to read about it. You can also watch the movie. I don't particularly recommend the movie. It's got too much Hollywood in it for me, but the basic facts are correct. Cast the Giant's Shadow, the book and the movie. And so while Jerusalem was under siege, here to the south of the main road is the Burma Road, built to bypass Latrun in the Dayer-Abir section of the main road. And here's a picture of, I thought this originally was a picture of the construction of the road, but it isn't. It's actually a bulldozer towing one of the armored vehicles up the more impassable sections of the road. There's a cable attached to that bulldozer, and he's towing that truck up the road. Here's a medical van loaded with medical supplies being towed up that same section of the Burma Road, relieving the siege of Jerusalem. And, of course, the first convoy made it into Jerusalem just a short time before the United Nations truce settled over the area. And this is a section of the Burma Road today. Israelis walk the road to celebrate Israel Independence Day, and as you can see, it's just a dirt road wide enough for one vehicle at a time. So that's just one short section of the Burma Road today. Okay, the first United Nations truce came into effect, and the nation had not been squeezed out of existence militarily. The nation now consisted of the jet black area. And you have this map, by the way, on page 159. So the nation was not squeezed out of existence. It still was in existence as that jet black area. And during the 30-day truce, everybody, all the protagonists, rearmed, and then the Israelis went on the offensive. By the second United Nations truce, the IDF had expanded its territorial gains to the dark gray area. Originally, the nation was the black area. Now it consists of the dark gray area. So the nation has now increased in its territory. And that brings us to page 156 and the liberation of the Negev. Yes. Okay, just a second. I'll turn that the sound off here. That should do it, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the other speakers for the DVD. Okay. All right, the Negev liberated, page 156. Everybody get there okay?
Yep.
All righty. In the last days before the imposition of the second truce, the Jews managed to recapture a number of villages in the northwestern corner of the Negev. That's the south, the desert. The majority of the Negev settlements still remained under Egyptian blockade. As Yadin and his staff viewed it, strategic consideration alone would have dictated a future Israeli offensive in the desert. It was agreed that the Egyptian danger was potentially the greatest, and the priority henceforth would be given to a full-scale offensive in the Negev. In preparation for the new offensive, Israeli transport planes ferried men and material to an airstrip carved out in the northern Negev. From August until late October 1948, some 2,000 tons of equipment and 1,900 troops were carried down in this fashion. Under cover of darkness, the soldiers were infiltrated into the Negev kibbutzim until a full Israeli brigade was operating behind Egyptian lines. Top of page 157. During the same period, Yigdal alone slowly moved his veteran northern brigades southward. By mid-October, the young commander had 30,000 troops at his disposal on a single front, the southern front there, plus a small air fighter squadron. And he chafed impatiently to be on the offensive. The opportunity came October 14th. With UN approval, the Israelis set out to provision their settlements by conducting an unarmed convoy across the Egyptian-controlled Fallujah crossroads. Now here's a map of what's going on. On the screen you can see that the blue area is the area controlled by Israel. So we have a blue area to the top and a blue area to the south, north and south. And in between, you see a pink corridor. That's the area controlled by the Egyptian army. That is the area called the Fallujah Crossroads. That's the area we're talking about here. So the Israelis, with the permission of the UN, are sending an unarmed convoy across that area to resupply the kibbutzim there. Now, look what happens. The moment the column drew within sight of the farms, the lead vehicles were blown to bits. Kaboom! Lead vehicles go up. But note, the fact, undetected by the UN observers, is that the Israelis themselves dynamited those trucks. And armed with that pretext, alone went into action immediately. That was just a pretext. They faked him out. The speed with which he launched this offensive was a shattering surprise to the Egyptians. Soon, the major concentration of Egyptian troops in the Negev, some 35,000 men, faced the possibility of defeat or entrapment near Fallujah. The British introduced a resolution in the Security Council demanding yet another Palestine ceasefire, and the measure was adopted. During the next week, October 22nd, as the UN truce gradually settled on the desert, the Egyptians began evacuating units from the western Negev. So here is the situation at the third United Nations truce. From the black area, the nation has now expanded to the dark gray area, and now the nation has expanded to the light gray area, almost the borders of today. So that's the situation at the end of the third UN truce. So now we come to the final campaign of the War of Independence. As 1948 drew to a close, the Jews were making preparations to attack and eradicate the Egyptian army's last remaining garrison on Israeli territory. The purpose was to establish the irrefutable fact of Israel's sovereign power and viability and to bring the end of the war altogether. The objective became Al-Aouja, the anchor of the Egyptian position in the Negev Desert. And again, here's our map. And if you look at the very southern end of the map, that's Al-Aouja. There's where the center of the Egyptian arms, right there. Center of the Egyptian army was right there. Now, if Al-Aouja fell, it would break the back of the Egyptian military effort. Al-Aouja was well protected by sizable Egyptian artillery and tank units, so a direct assault was hardly feasible, you know, from north to south. Yadin discovered a solution not in his military manuals, but in his archaeological guide to Greco-Roman Israel. All right, this is the way the Lord works, doesn't he? He brings what you need when you need it from the least expected source, right? This is an archaeological guide, not a military guide. He found out, he noticed that an ancient Roman road ran south of Al-Aouja. That would be a paved road, paved with Roman flagstones, a road that could support modern trucks, etc. Okay? So under cover of darkness, engineers repaired the most difficult stretches of this ancient route of march. You know, it was 2,000 years old. Some parts of it needed to be repaired. So they fixed it up. Notice, the work was completed in such uncanny silence. This is at night, under cover of darkness, in the desert, where sound travels very, very easily. In such uncanny silence that the Egyptian outposts less than 2 miles away remained completely unsuspecting. On the night of December 22nd, the offensive began. A column of half-tracks and troop carriers moved along the Roman road. At dawn, December 26th, the Jews were within firing range of Al-Aouja. And so the Israelis were able to attack the defenders from behind, from the south. Although stunned, the Egyptians fought back courageously. For a full day and a night of close quarter fighting, or I should say after a full day and a night of close quarter fighting, they finally surrendered. Their commander, their colonel, was still in his pajamas. The surprise had caught him in bed. He didn't have a chance to get his jammies off, you know. Now, Israel went on to conduct raids across the international border into the Sinai itself. So note, the Jews had come a lot farther in 8 months than the limited distance of mere geographical advance. in May, at the beginning, in May, their ill-armed little militia had faced Egyptian tanks only 16 miles from Tel Aviv. In December, this is 7 months, you guys, half a year, 7 months. Their battle-seasoned troops, supported by armor and fighter planes, were driving into Egypt and cutting the last exit routes of the Egyptian army. Is that astounding? Is that unbelievable? 7 months from virtually a militia to a modern army? And yet the Lord saw that it happened. Help, however, came to a distraught Egypt. Under the terms of the 1936 Anglo-Egyptian Treaty, Britain was obliged to assist Egypt in the event of an attack from an outside party. Didn't matter that the Egyptians had attacked first. Now the outside party was digging into the Egyptian territory. In December 29th, the Security Council ordered an immediate ceasefire in Israel. It called for a permanent armistice on all sections of the area, permanent ceasefire. Now, it was Britain's chance to revive its tenuous presence in the area. London chose this moment to deliver a warning. Unless Israel obeyed the Security Council resolution, Britain would employ its forces in accordance with the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty. The ultimatum was a chilling one. Ben-Gurion didn't dare risk a confrontation with a great power. Yadin agreed, and the Israeli armed forces had won too much to gamble with their victory right now. So on January 2nd, beginning of 1949, orders reached Yigdal Alon to withdraw his men from the Sinai. All right, let's take a look at this on the map. Here is your map on page 159. And this is the area where the IDF was penetrating into Egyptian territory proper. See that? We'll get a little close up here. In the key to the right-hand side of your box, you see the dotted line. Territory occupied by Israeli forces from which they withdrew during the early months of 1949. So that's the incursions that the IDF was now making into Egypt proper that caused Britain to say, we're going to step in if you guys don't step out. All right, in 1949, we're now on page 160. Ceasefire agreements with Egypt, Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. In January 1949, initial discussions opened between Israel and Egypt on the island of Rhodes. Now, just to give you a geographical fix, here is a satellite view of Israel on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. And if we go west, that island is the island of Rhodes, owned by Greece. This is a territory owned by Greece. So that's where the negotiations were carried out. As the first step, the armistice agreement was drawn up on the basis of the existing military line. Each side assumed that the armistice would be supplanted in the near future by a permanent peace treaty. Now, it was signed February 24, 1949. The precedent established at Rhodes was generally followed in subsequent negotiations between Israel and the Arab states. Once Egypt, the greatest Arab power, the strongest Arab power, had signed a treaty with the Jews, it was much less difficult for the others to follow. Arab pride. You know, Arab pride. Well, if the Egyptians can do it, I guess we can do it. So, agreements with Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan were all signed by July 20th. Now, these are armistice agreements. These are ceasefire agreements. These are not peace agreements. These are not peace treaties. Okay? These armistice agreements state, we are still at war with you, but we're just not going to fire a shot right now. Okay, do you understand that? A peace agreement says, we are no longer at war with you. So this is only armistice agreements, ceasefire agreements. Question? Yes, these are still in effect, except Egypt and Jordan has now signed peace agreements with Israel. We'll talk about that as we get into that. But these armistice agreements, for example, Lebanon, and Syria are still technically in a state of war with Israel. Iraq, still technically in a state of war with Israel. Saudi Arabia, still technically in a state of war with Israel. Israel lives in a tough neighborhood. Okay? The other nations have not followed Egypt and Jordan signing peace agreements, peace treaties with Israel. Okay? All right. Iraq was the only Arab belligerent not to sign an armistice agreement directly with Israel. They didn't even say we'll stop firing. The agreements left Israel in possession of approximately 8,000 square miles of land, or 21% more land than allotted under the partition plan. So you have this small map on page 160, and this map is the... Well, you have the next map coming up. This is the United Nations Resolution 181 that was approved November 29, 1947. The blue area is the Jewish state. The orange area is the Arab state. Okay? Now, it is now 1949, and this is the way it looks. Okay? The blue is the Jewish state, and the orange is the territory that Jordan captured. Of course, red is the Gaza Strip. Okay. Say again.
It looks almost white.
Looks kind of white here. Light blue. Yeah, light blue. The dark blue, we'll get to the dark blue here in just a second. This is a close-up of the armistice agreement with Jordan. With Jordan, the Israelis gained the dark blue area. They were given the dark blue area. So the blue areas are the state of Israel. The orange area there is the west bank of the Jordan River. It is now occupied by the nation of Jordan. It is not the nation of Palestine. It is not the Palestine Authority. The orange area there is occupied by Jordan and will be occupied by Jordan for some 20 years. Okay? No state of Palestine exists at this time. Does not exist at this time. That is the territory. That area will be annexed by Jordan illegally, as we'll see in just a little bit.
So
question.
The Gaza Strip was over to Jordan.
The Gaza Strip is now occupied by Egypt. The red area, the Gaza Strip is now occupied by Egypt. There's no Palestine. Okay. The orange is occupied by Jordan. Everything else is Israel. Okay. Note that. Okay. Burn that into your brain. No nation of Palestine exists at this point in time. It would have had they accepted the UN resolution and divided the land up, a nation of Palestine would exist. But it doesn't now because they rejected it.
Even though they still refused to give up the name.
Oh, yeah. They refused to give up the name. Yeah, sure. Because they want everything from the Jordan to the ocean. All righty. At this time, we're going to look at another video after our break. Another story from Against All Odds, because I don't want this to be dull, dry facts, you know. I want you to understand the human element in history. And this is current history, and there's a very human element to it. We're going to be looking at the segment called Shula, the girl who became a spy. She was a spy for Israel during I think it began in 1947. And she was very, very effective. This is an Israeli woman. Well, a Lebanese Jew. She's a Lebanese Jew, actually. Because she was a Lebanese citizen. Okay, she was not an Israeli citizen. She was a Lebanese Jewish person. Now, anyway, this is the only segment that I'm aware of where the actual person who participated in what happened is not interviewed. Okay, they interview, as I understand it, if I remember right from looking at this, they interviewed Shula. Greenspan interviewed Shula. But Shula did not want to be put on camera, okay? But she did authorize the use of an actress in her place. So the woman you see being interviewed is an actress, but the dialogue came from the actual interview with Shula, okay? Because Shula was not comfortable with that. All righty, so question.
Is she still alive?
I don't know if she's still alive. I don't know if she's still alive right now. Okay, And by the way, you can read a book. I didn't get to put this video in this slide up there. There's a book on Amazon called The Pearl, which is the story of Shula Cohen. Okay, The Pearl. I'm not familiar with that book, but one of the students in the morning class said it does exist. And by the way, I was also told by another student that when the Lebanese talk about her, they call her a whore and a prostitute and a terrible person, and they leave out all that they did to her when they were torturing her. So anyway, so you're gonna get a little bit of that, okay? So that's the Lebanese view. they hate her. So anyway, after the break, we'll look at Shula, the girl who became a spy. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar, and we'll pick it up in 15 minutes.